This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Hi, I'm Paul Fotenauer, and welcome to Frontiers, where we showcase UC Davis research that helps us understand and live in a changing world. Since ancient times, people have been enjoying both beer and wine and proclaiming their usefulness for curing a multitude of ailments. In recent years, researchers are learning that there just might be sound science behind what was once thought to be mere folk medicine. Our guests today on Frontiers are two UC Davis experts in the science of winemaking and brewing who have studied the potential health benefits of wine and beer. Charlie Bamforth is the Anheuser-Busch Professor of Malting and Brewing Sciences and Chair of UC Davis's Food Science and Technology Department. He is the author of several books on brewing and malting science, and he has studied the nutritional merits of beer. Professor Andy Waterhouse holds the John E. Kinsella Endowed Chair in Food, Nutrition, and Health. He is a wine chemist and chair of the UC Davis's Viticulture and Enology Department. His research focuses on the chemicals that affect the taste of wine and those that relate to the health effects of wine for consumers. They have joined us today to explain how beer and wine might justifiably be considered part of a healthy diet. Gentlemen, welcome to Frontiers.
Thank you.
Professor Bamford, first question. It seems that beer and ale have been considered blue-collar beverages, and wine is a more sophisticated drink. Is that a fair characterization?
I think they would take issue with that in some parts of the world. If you go to a country like Belgium or the Czech Republic, beer is held in true reverence and is really second to none in terms of alcoholic beverages. In a country like the United States, I think possibly you may interpret it that way, and I think it's the way in which beer perhaps has been presented. It's always been the perhaps more economically priced and therefore, for that reason, perhaps appeals and has always attracted more people. It also is a drink for probably more drinking occasions, and so it does appeal to many more stages in which you would want to perhaps take a drink. If we go back thousands of years, perhaps in the days of ancient Rome, where the grapes were sweeter, and of course the grain-derived drinks were less sweet, perhaps it was easier to drink the wine than it was the beer in those far-off days.
Now, Professor Waterhouse, we've heard a lot about the health benefits of both beer and wine. Now, how did your laboratory go about looking at the potential health benefits of wine?
Well, it started when I first got here in 1991. The dean of the College of Agriculture, John Kinsella, was actually doing a research project with some other faculty in the food science department, and they published a paper where they claimed to show the answer to the French paradox. They showed that wine contained an antioxidant, the polyphenols, and heart disease is known to be caused by oxidation in the arteries. So they created a hypothesis that was very powerful and really launched the whole sort of enterprise of studying the wine and health,
So what compounds were the focus of your research, and then what did you discover?
Well, initially, there was a report very shortly after that that showed that wine contained resveratrol. And resveratrol is found in some herbal medicines where they're actually prescribed for heart disease. So there was a lot of interest in resveratrol from day one, and we actually got involved with that and did some analysis of resveratrol in wine. What we found, though, was that the level in wine was very low and probably couldn't explain the whole French paradox. So we started looking at other compounds and did a lot of research on what's called catechin. It's another phenol. It's called a flavonoid. You may have heard the term flavonoid. And we actually showed that when drinkers consume wine, the catechin shows up in their blood.
So how do antioxidants affect a person's risk of developing, say, heart disease?
Well, the early theory was that by simply blocking oxidation in the bloodstream, you arrest the formation of plaque in the arteries. I think nowadays we understand it's much more sophisticated than that, and it's not, you don't just consume antioxidants and they stop oxidation in the blood. It's a much more complicated process that involves inflammation and blocking inflammation.
What about other risks like cancer?
Well, the cancer story is a little bit ambiguous right now. There's a lot of interest in this, and there's a lot of research looking at flavonoids and cancer. But if you look at the food consumption data, I think listeners might be very surprised to hear that there's some people in the research community saying there aren't really good links between diet and cancer, at least for all cancers. For some cancers, definitely. But for all cancer, the evidence is a bit weak.
Well, Charlie, let's talk about what research has shown about beer's potential for lowering the risk of, say, heart disease.
Well, there have been many studies worldwide of the relationship between drinking alcoholic beverages generally, and the risk of heart disease. And there are so many studies now that have shown that the effects are just as real for beer as they are for wine. And there is now a really strong body of evidence that although polyphenols have a role to play, it's probably the alcohol itself, which is one of the key ingredients. There was a very famous study you reported in the British Medical Journal a number of years ago, which said that really no difference between wine and beer when consumed in the equivalent quantities. So beer also has polyphenolic materials. Andy's mentioned things like catechin. It's present in beer as well, and some others as well. And there have been studies showing that for one particular antioxidant, it gets into the body more efficiently from beer than it does from a tomato. If I went down to the local farmer's market and said, here's a beer and here's a tomato, which is healthier, most people would say it's the tomato. But actually, for at least this particular antioxidant, it would actually be the beer.
Is that because it's a liquid?
The matrix does help. The matrix does help, and whether it's taken in the form of liquid. And, of course, we believe that the presence of alcohol in alcoholic beverages also impacts the ability of various things to get into the body. So I think the evidence really is that when you consider atherosclerosis, that the beer, wine, they're probably as effective as one another.
When it comes to wine...
Well, wait, I want to make one comment. I think there are also quite a few studies that actually show discrimination between the beverages, quite a few very good ones, in fact, based on epidemiology. These are not clinical studies. And quite a few of them do show more benefit for wine than for beer. And not all of them, but there are quite a few. So I take a little bit of issue with the fact that all the beverages are completely equivalent.
Well, equally, studies that are done, and it's remarkable, studies that are done in beer-drinking countries actually reveal the benefit of beer. Those that are done overtly in a wine-drinking country is surprising that they actually show benefit for wine.
So are you saying that science is biased?
No, I'm not saying that science is biased, but I'm talking about the populations involved. You know, in a beer-drinking country such as Belgium or the Czech Republic or Germany, more people, they drink larger quantities of beer. And the studies, the analysis of these investigations obviously is going to feature more beer drinkers. And what a surprise, they actually are healthy because they drink beer in moderation.
So if I go out to dinner tonight with my wife, do I order a glass of beer or do I have a glass of wine?
Which do you prefer? You have what you enjoy, as long as you do it in moderation, of course. But I would say that beer probably complements more foodstuffs than does wine, and therefore I personally would vote for beer. But then again, I would, wouldn't I?
Well, I would second Charlie's comment. I think you should drink whatever alcoholic beverage you prefer to drink with a meal. I actually think that wine complements food a little bit better. The acidity, astringency, especially with a nice steak, for instance, really matches well. The other thing is, I think wine, because wine is sour and astringent, and that some people don't like that, that taste actually controls your intake. So it's really not pleasant to drink. Drink wine in large quantities because of this taste.
So from a health benefit, though, which drink is better?
Well, as I say, my interpretation of what's gone on worldwide is that if you look at the classic U or J-shaped curve, the risk of death versus moderate alcohol intake, that the results for wine and beer are very similar. I would suggest that beer is the drink of moderation. One of the reasons is it's actually in defined units. You know, you have a can or a bottle, a 12-ounce serving, or a pint, whereas with other drinks, it depends on the heaviness of your pour. So you can control your, you understand your beer intake rather better. In terms of the other composition, beer has actually got quite a lot of nutrients in there. You know, there's this myth that it's empty calories. That is just so much garbage. Beer contains significant levels of B vitamins. It contains some of these antioxidants, as I've mentioned. It contains, it's a very rich source of silicon. It's one of the richest sources of silicon in the diet. So I would say that beer is rather better.
Andy, I would think you don't agree.
I think there's, you know, beer contains a lot of silicon. That's great. But, you know, I think the data is very clear that wine consumers benefit from the health effect of drinking wine. I go back to the first answer, which is I think it's most important is moderate intake, regular intake. That's where you get the real benefit. It's not by drinking a lot on the weekends. And whatever beverage you prefer to drink in that way is going to provide you with the most health benefit.
It seems that red wine may be healthier than white wine. If that's true, why?
Well, in fact, the data on this is a bit weak. But if there is an explanation, it really goes back to these polyphenols. There's much more of that in red wine, about 10 times as much. So these are the antioxidants I was talking about earlier. And then when you consume that wine, you get more of that in the bloodstream, and that's supposed to be the cause of reducing heart disease. But the difficulty is in getting sort of clean data from epidemiological studies. That's where we gather data on existing populations. You know, what you really need is you need two villages in France, side by side, which have completely identical diets. And in one town, they drink nothing but beer, and the other town, they drink nothing but white wine. And in the third town, they drink nothing but red wine. And then we'd have the answer.
Yeah. It really is difficult because there are so many confounding factors. You've got to take into consideration people's lifestyle. There was a very interesting study recently in Denmark where they actually looked at the checkout printouts in a supermarket, and they were comparing people who were buying wine and people who were buying beer. The people who were buying wine were buying lettuce and low-fat yogurt. The people who were buying beer were buying sausages and meat and probably cigarettes as well. So, you know, it's part of the whole lifestyle thing as well.
You talked a little bit earlier about moderation. Is that important with regard to the health benefits? If you drink too much wine, the benefits of it go the other way and beer?
That's critical.
Yes, definitely. There have been a number of studies now that have looked at what are called consumption patterns. And if you drink your 7 drinks in the 7 days of a week, you gain great benefit. And if you drink them all on Friday night, it actually is a big health risk. So it's very important.
Absolutely. And the frequency has been highlighted. But, you know, frequency and moderation, so no more than 1 or 2 drinks per day, but 7 days a week, and certainly not accumulating. And that's binge drinking, and binge drinking is a serious problem.
We have 30 seconds left. I'd like to ask you one more question. That is, how long will it take before we resolve this issue as to what's better, beer or wine?
Well, I think the difficult thing is the real answer is going to come from a controlled clinical study where we give people beer or wine, what have you. And I think that's going to be very difficult to do in a controlled, double-blind situation. And, you know, it's going to have to be long-term, so it's going to be very hard to get there.
And you can't control all the other things people do with their lives. Virtually impossible to do it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for appearing on Frontiers. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who joined us for today's discussion. You can learn more about this subject by visiting our website at frontiers.ucdavis.edu. A growing population means growing more food. But can farmers get more bountiful harvests from the land without threatening the environment or taking away land from other needs? Our two guests today argue that biotechnology, genetically engineered crops, is key to the future of food. Pam Ronald is a professor of plant pathology and leads the plant genome program at UC Davis. Much of her work has focused on rice, the staple diet of half the world's population, more than 3 billion people. She has worked with the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines and with rice growers both in the U.S. and in developing countries. In 1996, she established the Genetic Resources Recognition Fund, a UC Davis program to share benefits of biotechnology with developing countries. In a forthcoming book, Ronald and her husband, who manages the Student Organic Farm on campus, argue that the future of food is a marriage of organic farming and genetic engineering. Eduardo Blumwall holds the Will W. Lester Chair in Pomology in the Department of Plant Sciences at UC Davis. Blumwall's laboratory studies a wide range of plants, including rice, wheat, cotton, and citrus fruit, as well as model plants such as tobacco and tomatoes. His special interest is in developing salt-tolerant and drought-tolerant plants that can grow in soils affected by salinity. Thank you both for coming on Frontiers.
Thank you.
Pam, could you tell us what really genetic engineering is?
Genetic engineering is a form of crop modification, but it differs from standard breeding techniques that we've been using for many years. Genetic engineering has been around for about 30 years, and the major difference is that with genetic engineering, you can introduce a gene into a plant from any species. So it introduces this idea that you have a vast potential for genetic alteration of a plant.
Now, Professor Blumwall, how does this differ from what they did 10,000 years ago with traditional plant breeding?
Essentially, it's not very different. 10,000 years ago, when you cross two plants, you are going to put part of a chromosome that contains genes, many genes, from one plant to the other. What you do with genetic engineering, essentially, you are tailoring a particular gene. You use methodology to just isolate that particular gene. But essentially, you are transferring genes. So, besides the how to you do it, it's exactly the same.
So what are the potential uses of genetic engineering in food crops, Pam?
Well, there's a couple traits out there, and one of the most important, I think, is for reducing the use of pesticides. So there's a pest-resistant crop that's available. And in the future, there is hope that we'll be able to engineer plants to withstand diverse environmental stresses.
Are there other potential uses?
No, essentially, those are very important. One of the things that we have to recognize is that we are incrementing our production. The Green Revolution has brought massive amounts of production from the 60s up, and we are now reaching a plateau because something has to give. We are obviously extensively using our natural resources, and as a consequence of that, we are facing deterioration of our soils. We are imposing, if you want, with larger production, extreme conditions for growth.
Now, would organic farmers agree with that?
Well, yeah, I assume that, yes. The only problem when you talk about organic farmers, you are talking about scales. Organic farming is a relatively small scale of farming and pleases, if you want, a particular sector of the population that can afford organic grown products. When you go to the large part of this world that cannot afford that, cannot afford those prices, well, you are thinking in a total different scale. So, yes and no.
So Pam, do you think that there definitely is a need for genetic engineering?
Yes, I do. I think we need to combine genetic engineering with the concepts that organic farmers have really brought to the forefront. And what's interesting is organic farming started moving forward quite rapidly in the United States about 30 years ago, the same time that genetic engineering was discovered. So I see these as two parallel processes that are bound to intersect. And the reason is organic farmers have really been careful to think about reducing the amounts of pesticides and fertilizers in the environment. As we know, some pesticides can be toxic to farm workers, and runoff of fertilizers creates environmental problems. We also need to be sensitive to the local communities and to the poor and malnourished. So I think if we take the modern genetic techniques of genetic engineering and combine those with the sort of production agriculture, that we can end up with a much better food supply that will benefit more people.
But don't you think organic farmers are the biggest skeptics of genetic engineering?
No, I don't think so, actually. In the Davis community, there's quite a mixture of geneticists and organic farmers. And the farmers are the ones that really know what the environmental problems are. They're aware of soil erosion. They're very aware of overuse of pesticides and fertilizers. And virtually all organic farmers I've talked to are very interested in genetic engineering.
Eduardo, do you agree that they can coexist peacefully?
Oh, absolutely. I think that coexistence is not the problem. The problem is how we can solve the problems at a different scale. I think that, as I said, in a relatively small scale, when you compare the world, I think organic farming is great. It's a great deal. The only problem is that when you go now to places like Africa and Asia and South America, some places in the States where the erosion of the natural resources are so huge and the limitations, lack of water, bad soil, increased salinity in the soil, you have to attempt new methodology and try to generate plants that are able to grow on that. And I think in those environments, organic farming as it is right now is going to be limited.
So you're talking about economic constraints. Are there political constraints to genetic engineering?
Political constraints? There are a lot of political constraints.
And how's the scientific community handling those constraints?
Well, the problem is it's market-driven. So there's been two large many reviews, but the United Kingdom carried out a 5-year scientific review of genetic engineering. They had a moratorium on planting of genetically engineered crops for 5 years. And at the end of that, they concluded that genetic engineering poses no new risks that we don't have with traditional breeding, although each new genetically engineered plant has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. The National Academy of Science has concluded the exact same thing, that the process is not inherently more risky than traditional breeding. But it depends what trait you put into the plant, so everything has to be looked at separately. I think the problem is now it's really market-driven, because there are a lot of consumers that are fearful of genetically engineered food. They have the perception that it could hurt you, and of course, there has been no environmental or health issue associated with genetically engineered foods. The public doesn't really know that. And because of that, countries are reluctant to grow and export genetically engineered food because of their markets.
The European Union is an example of that. So, Eduardo, what are the safety and environmental concerns that you have?
None whatsoever. In fact, today in the UK, there are one transgenic sugar beet has been given the get-go, and there are another 17 different cultivars under examination, growth, etc., etc., in Europe. I have no problem, actually.
It sounds like genetic engineering may have a PR problem. Is that true?
That is true.
It's more than that. There is a political issue behind that we should not avoid. And the problem is the politics of the world has changed in the last 10 or 12 years. And then we have a lot of youngsters that need really reasons, la raison d'être, why we are and against what. Multinationals are not very friendly. They are giving a bad, they have no PR policy trying to explain the people why there's no problem with transgenic crops. And then there has been this politically driven bad PR.
You agree with that, don't you?
I think it's a little more complex than that. I think the multinational corporations are trying to have a large publicity campaign, but most of the public doesn't trust the multinational corporations, so I think it really needs to be science-based. I think we need to look very carefully at the science, and it is a relatively new technology. It's only 30 years old. It depends what gene is put into the plant. Theoretically, a gene could be put into a plant that can make it move into the wild population, although that's never occurred in the past with any domesticated species. The domesticated species usually stay in the farms because they're sort of crippled. They need a lot of fertilizer, they need a lot of water, so they generally don't move out into the population. But we need to be very careful, and we need to look at that very carefully.
And we do. There's nothing more check and double check than the transgenic crop. You have in the United States, you have the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, that looks at the particular properties of the products, and then you have other agencies, Environmental Protection Agency, Food and Drug Administration, that are going to run extensive tests for 5, 6, 7 years in order to give you the green light and exhaust every single possibility that the composition of that crop is good for you, or at least it's not bad for you, that plant is not going to start growing wildly everywhere.
Let me just ask Pam about rice. That's such a major crop for the world. Now, what are you doing in your lab to make this work universally?
We're interested in improving rice tolerance to stress. The reason this is important is because many rice plants grow in areas where there are many stresses. Eduardo can talk about some. And one thing we've been looking at in my lab is tolerance to flooding or submergence. So in South and Southeast Asia, there's 140 million farmers that live in these flood-prone zones. And we know as scientists that there is a gene that allows the plant to withstand flooding. It allows the plant to stay underwater for 2 weeks. However, using standard breeding approaches, breeders were unable to introduce this gene into rice varieties. So over the last 20 years, my colleagues at the International Rice Research Institute and I, as well as a group from UC Riverside, have tried to understand and isolate this gene, and we have been successful, and we've genetically engineered rice plants that are able to withstand flooding for 2 weeks.
Good. In a word, but what about you?
Well, I'm going to talk from the other side of the water. She has too much. Let's talk California, Southern California. And in 2003, we signed up 20% of the water that comes from the Colorado River to the Imperial Valley to San Diego County. They don't have water for people. So we are losing already 20% of the water, and 20% of the land is going to disappear. We are missing water everywhere. And it's becoming, with climate change, increased population, increased production, we have no water. So we have to design plants that are able to sustain growth under limiting water conditions.
And you've had some success.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We are having incredible success on that. Other thing, increased salinity. And as you know, we have shown that we can grow plants in high salinity. Or, for example, fruits. Why not to increase the amount of antioxidants in the fruit and make it more healthier for you?
I wish we had more time. But this is interesting. And keep up the good work in your labs, all right? Thanks for joining us on Frontiers.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who joined us for today's discussion. You can learn more about this subject by visiting our website at frontiers.ucdavis.edu.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.